You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams July Summer Sale and get 30% off paints and stains July 18th through the 28th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Today on The Grave Talks, what's on the other side? A conversation with Rick Hale.
Well, first off, this is a memory that is burned into my brain for all time. Like, I will never forget why I'm involved in this field. Mm-hmm. When I was 8 years old, I was staying the weekend with my cousin at my grandparents' house in Franklin Park, Illinois. Now, for people who don't know where Franklin Park, Illinois is, Franklin Park is a large town on the northwest side of Chicago. So, you know, I'm sorry.
You're fine.
My dog is barking. I am very much a Chicago native. My co-host on my show, he never lets me forget that by constantly making fun of my accent. But so late one night, my cousin and I, we had just got done watching a Cubs game, and it was in September of 1982. Of course, they lost because that's what the Cubs do, but we love them anyways.
Sure.
And so my cousin had already fallen asleep, and I've always been very much a night owl, even as a little kid. So, you know, for people who don't know what these old flats look like in Franklin Park or in the Chicagoland area, you have the front room, and then you have a long hall that leads off towards the back. And that's where you find like bedrooms and the kitchen and all that. It was a very old building. I think it was like 150 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. So my grandmother always left the bathroom light on for us kids, because this long hallway did not have a light in it. So I got up and I had to use the bathroom. So I'm walking towards the bathroom and I see the light. And in the bathroom, I see like somebody moving around, like a shadow. And my cousin was sleeping, you know, not 5 feet away from me. And my grandparents had been fast asleep for a long time. And in their bedroom, they had a bathroom anyways. So they wouldn't have come out there to use that bathroom. And we were the only people in the house. So I'm walking up to the bathroom door. And then all of a sudden, the light just turns off. Now, I'm 8 years old, and it is pitch black. It is not, it is an unenviable position to be in at the time. And the door opens up, and this woman steps out. And it's not my grandmother. My grandmother was Native American. She was mm-hmm. Cherokee. So she was very, very short. She was a very short woman, maybe about 4'10", 4'11". She was tiny. And this was a very tall woman. And I'm looking up at her, and she turns around and she looks at me and feels my chin. And when she feels my chin, I just feel like this static electricity go throughout my entire body. Like I'm charged. And she says in a very beautiful but thick Irish accent, "My, what a fine young lad." And then she turns, walks towards the kitchen, and I just watch her as she fades away.
Yeah.
Now, I know that most people think, oh my God, this 8-year-old kid is terrified. That's not the case at all. I had a very good feeling about this person. I actually still get goosebumps every time I tell this story. Mm-hmm. So I had very good feelings with this apparition. Of course, I didn't know it was an apparition at the time.
Sure.
And the very next morning, I'm talking to my grandmother, and it turns out that not only does my grandmother see her all the time, but my uncle Luis had seen her as well. And she told me, she's like, "That's just Mrs. McNett, and you don't have to be afraid of her at all." So Mrs. McNett was the wife of the gentleman who owned my grandparents' house that they lived in.
Okay.
And he lived on the top floor. They lived on the main level. Mm-hmm. And she had died in 1972.
And she's still there.
Yeah, she had been dead for 10 years. And it turns out I wasn't the only person that had an intense experience with her. My cousin Vicky, the Hale side of the family is originally from Alabama, mm-hmm. and a lot of the family, they still live down there. Well, once when she was a kid, Vicky had come to visit, and my grandparents, they had one of those old stoves that even when it was off, you still didn't touch it
because
sure. you might still burn yourself. So Vicky was telling me that she got a little bit too close. And she hears a woman with an Irish accent say in her ear, "Don't get too close now. You may burn yourself." So everybody knew that my grandparents' house was haunted.
Sure.
You know, for lack of a better term, inhabited, whatever. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew it. But as far as I know, me, my grandma, and my uncle Luis are the only three people to have ever seen her, whereas everybody else has experienced, you know, things like, you know, like footsteps, cold breezes,
yeah.
taps on the shoulder, voices. And it's, you know, it's really sad to say my cousin, Luis Jr., we call him Booski. Booski contacted me a couple of years ago, and, you know, the sad news is my grandparents' house got torn down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, I don't know. It's possible that Mrs. McNett might still be there mm-hmm. tied to the ground. But yeah, that was a real intense first experience. And I know that a lot of people are like, you know, my first experience was real negative, man. And, you know, this ghost haunted me. But my first experience was very positive.
How do you think that then affected your future kind of outlook on this whole subject? After, you know, literally almost having a warm and fuzzy experience with the dead.
Yeah. You know, I get that question a lot. And basically it set me on a path of looking into these things from a positive light, you know, from about the age of 8 years old to 17, those were the times of study and research and reading everything that I possibly could. You know, I had two very good resources. My dad lived in Chicago, so I had the Chicago Public Library. My mother lived in Round Lake Beach, Illinois, which is, you know, like a stone's throw away from the Wisconsin border.
Sure.
So I had those two libraries that I could really count on. But the thing is back then it was still very much a taboo kind of thing. So you couldn't just walk into a library or a bookstore and find stacks and stacks of books. I was lucky if I found a few. So, you know, I read people like Hans Holzer, Peter Underwood, Elliot O'Donnell, Harry Price, Brad Steiger. I read all of those gentlemen. So I had like a real good base because they also had a way of approaching this from a very objective and very positive way. Sure, my very first experience with the dead was very positive. My first investigation, it not so much.
No.
My first investigation happened when I was 17 years old. I was just going into my senior year of high school. And I get a call from a friend of mine who was involved in this church ministry. At the time, I was, you know, kind of, I wouldn't say I was a religious person, but I was a person of some faith.
Sure.
Although I never abandoned this research and investigation. And so she called me up and she's like, look, I have this girl living with me right now. She's 16 years old and I'm going to call her Susie because I can't give her a real name.
Sure.
And so my friend, we'll call her Denise. Denise tells me that ever since Susie came to visit, to live with us, because she was part of this ministry that helped kids get out of cults and abusive situations. She's like, ever since this girl came to live with us, strange things have been happening in the house. There's like immense drops in temperature. And, you know, this is Northern Illinois in September, so it's still very hot. And this was a double wide trailer and they didn't have any AC in here. So it was hot like all the time.
Yeah.
So she's like, even with the windows open, it was still extraordinarily cold in the house. She's like, things are moving. We're seeing weird black shadows. We were kind of wondering if you could come over here and take a look at this, because I know that you're into this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm like, sure. I was hanging out with my girlfriend at the time, told her what was going on. She wasn't very happy, but you know, I smoothed things over afterwards.
Yeah.
They're the very next day. So I get to Denise's house and I meet with Susie, a very sweet, very pretty girl. And with quite a story to tell. And where she was originally from, again, I can't really say, it's another Midwestern state.
Yep.
And she said that in her hometown, she was involved with this, the best way that I could possibly put it is in this satanic sex cult.
Well, who hasn't been in one of those, you know?
Right? I mean, I'm personally in one right now. It's awful. Get lucky all the time.
You're like, oh, you too?
Let's get together.
Yes, you know?
But
yes.
No, so she starts telling me this story that she is pregnant with the child of the leader of this group, and they called him Blade. I know that sounds really corny and cheesy, but that's what the dude called himself.
Yeah.
This is some Stranger Things shit right here.
I mean, are you at this moment, what is going through your mind? Are you thinking this is crazy? This can't be real. Or are you like, let's hear the story.
I'm getting to that.
Yeah.
I'm getting to that. So, she starts telling me that this leader cursed her with these huge black masses that kind of follow her around and do things in her presence. Move stuff, throw stuff, you know, whatever. And so I'm thinking, yeah, okay. Now I know about poltergeist phenomena. I had studied it extensively in the 9 years between having my first experience and this first investigation. So I'm thinking, yeah, right, to the satanic sex cult thing and the curse. But I'm thinking, okay, this might be a poltergeist situation. So Denise goes to bed in her room, and Susie falls asleep on the couch in this adjoining room, and I'm in another room sitting in a chair. So I got, you know, my pen and my pad of paper, because that's, we didn't have all these really super cool gadgets that we all use today in the field. So I had, you know, a tape recorder, a camera, and a pen and paper, pad of paper. So I'm taking notes of everything, you know, this time and this time. So about 1:15-ish in the morning, the temperature in the place just drops. Now I'm wearing shorts and I'm wearing a t-shirt and I am cold. Like I've never felt a cold like this before. And then all of a sudden, Susie wakes up and she says, "Rick, they're here." So I'm like, okay, let's get this party started, right?
Yeah.
So I walk in the other room and it's colder than in that room than it is in the room that I was in. So I start speaking harshly to this thing. Now, I don't suggest that anybody ever does provoking, but I made it fashionable about 30 years before it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm speaking very harshly to this entity, not really believing that anything like this is there. And, you know, show yourself right now. I demand that you speak to me. I demand that you leave this girl alone. And then all of a sudden, this huge black mass appears in front of me. And the next thing I know, I am shoved on my ass, looking up at this thing as it just fades away.
Wow.
Yeah. So I know that a lot of people upon hearing this story are going to think things like, "Oh my God, you dealt with a demon." Well, demons are not really my forte. And if you want to talk a little bit more about that later on, mm-hmm. we can.
Sure.
But demons aren't really my thing. I'm a psychical researcher, which is more closely related to parapsychology than it is to anything church related.
Yeah.
So to this day, I honestly believe that my first investigation was dealing with recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, or RSPK, as it's called in psychical research, which of course is also a poltergeist.
Okay.
This is a person who is going through the trials and travails of puberty, or in her case, she is going through an extraordinarily stressful time in her life and she doesn't have an outlet. So it comes out in this kind of like psychic energy and just explodes in the physical environment and causes things to happen. And as far as this giant black mass is concerned, what I believe is I believe that that was a thought projection from mm-hmm. her, which is actually kind of common
yeah.
in poltergeist cases. She projected this. She believed that she was cursed with these beings, and so much that with this RSPK, she was able to project these things out into the physical environment. And maybe in some small way, she felt like I was threatening her. Therefore, she's going to direct this thought form to attack me, which it did.
Is that the big blob of energy, the darkness that you literally saw come out of her? Is that something that is conscious, that has a personality, that has a will, or is it literally just that, a blob of energy that it can't make decisions? It's just there.
Well, here's the thing. According to Tibetan Buddhism, there is a being that is called a tulpa, and a tulpa is created by sheer will. And do you know who Alexander David Neal is?
Not well.
Okay. Alexander David Neal was an early 20th century explorer. And while in Tibet, or it was either Tibet or Nepal. She was able, the monks that she met with created this tulpa, this thought form, and he had a physical form and he was male. And at first he was a servant to Alexandra David Neal. But over time, he turned from this very attractive young man to a very large man who was causing nothing but evil and trouble for Alexandra David Neal. So, you know, thanks to the Tibetan monks that she, you know, was, you know, hanging with, they were able to get rid of this tulpa. So, yes, there are these supernatural beings that that can be created through pure energy by sheer will. And we have the experience of this eminent explorer, early 20th century explorer and a researcher of the strange and unusual, and other experiences that people have in poltergeist situations where these kind of things are brought forth. One of them, of course, being the Black Monk of Pontefract. Are you familiar with that story?
Not really, no.
Okay. In 1967, the Pritchard family in Pontefract, United Kingdom, they were experiencing poltergeist activity in their home. Part of the way through the experience that they were having, this monk-like figure in a black robe appeared. Now, there are two kinds of people who think what was going on here. One, they think that this was the thought projection, a fear thought projection from the poltergeist focus, who was the Pritchard's son, or the energy of this poltergeist was so great that it actually drew in this this ghost, this like this free floating apparition or whatever. So, you know, but I think that that's one of the things that has kept me involved in this field for 40 years now. No matter how close you think you are to an answer, you're not. There's, you know, for every one answer you get, there's 1,000 more questions.
I completely agree. I mean, I've been doing this show for about 10 years now. And, you know, at the beginning, you start there and you think, oh, you know, maybe I'll get some more direction and I'll have some answers. Oh, no, I have far more questions than I do answers. I may be more informed than others, but I'm not an expert, but I have more stories that I can easily share with someone now and say, I've heard something similar, but here's what happened over here. Then after that, like, well, what's the solution? Nothing. That's just what happened over there. So you're not alone. That's kind of where it sits. There is no solution.
I think that anybody who's involved in this field and they're honest with themselves and with others will always say that there is no resolution. Many times there's no answers. There's always just more questions. But I think that that's what, you know, has kept me fascinated with all this for 40 years.
Sure. Yeah. It's just an endless digging. And every once in a while you get one where it's like, I haven't heard that before. It's rare, but it happens. And it just kind of gives you more and more questions. Something that I've been, you know, interested in as I've seemingly feel like there's been a trend on stories or this idea over the last couple of years. And maybe it's because so many people have been, you know, cooped up in their homes for the, you know, with the last 2 years with COVID and everything. And maybe it just was more time to kind of reflect on life or experience the stillness of life when you're at home. Is the idea that we're kind of haunting ourselves. And I know that plays into what you were talking about with the energy and the poltergeist type activity. But I mean, does it go beyond just here's a burst of energy and it ends up, you know, tipping over a vase or something like that? Is it something where like the tulpa thing where creating is it easier than we think, I guess, to create some sort of conscious entity that can go out there and have its own free will that maybe didn't exist? It wasn't like a human or your aunt or your uncle, and it wasn't the devil or the angel or this or that. It's something that our own energy somehow concocted, and now it's out there. And it's it does what it does because it has its own free will. Is that something?
Well, here's the thing about poltergeist and true hauntings or apparitional hauntings, ghost hauntings. You know, most people that experience a poltergeist will always say something like, the activity was brainless. Like, it seemed like a small child throwing a temper tantrum and getting completely out of control. Like, there's no direction. There's no rhyme or reason behind what it is doing.
Mm-hmm.
However, with a ghost or an apparition, a specter, phantom, whatever you choose to call it, if it is the intelligence of a person that has survived the death of the body, which I believe that many ghosts are,
mm-hmm.
They are going to have a purpose. They are going, well, I should rather say they will be purposeful. They will try to communicate. They will try to make contact. And unfortunately, a lot of people who experience this kind of thing, it frightens them because it is true to say that what we don't understand, we fear.
Sure.
So as the, you know, as a lifelong investigator, or I should rather say a longtime investigator, my life isn't quite over yet. You know, you meet a lot of these people, they're like, oh my God, I'm so scared of this ghost in my house. You know, it appears and it tries to touch me or it makes something move in the house. And it's like, I got to stop them and say, but wait a second. Let's look at this from the ghost's side of things. Maybe they're not trying to scare you.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're just trying to communicate and reach out. The problem is that they are on this other side of a veil, of the veil of life. They're in the ether and they can only do certain things to try and communicate with you. So you may be afraid. You may fear what this ghost is doing, but this ghost is just trying to say hi. And that's really something I try to really drive home to a lot of clients and a lot of people that I meet who claim to have a ghost in their house. It's like, just kind of chillax a little bit, just relax and try and see it from their perspective and understanding the psychology of this this discarnate entity. They're just trying to communicate. They're not trying to scare you.
What do you find the most common thing is that a spirit like that who was once living wants to get across? Is it their identity? Is it a message of some sort? Is there any sort of trend on that?
Both. I honestly do believe that it's both. I do believe that they are trying to give some kind of message. The only problem is that the passage of time is different for them. If they've been in a place for, say, 100 years, and their spirit, soul, whatever you may want to call it, is stuck there, they're not able to, you know, speak with their family that has passed on after them.
Mm-hmm.
So they're stuck kind of trying to talk to people that are, you know, real, that are human. And, you know, they may not understand that their loved ones are all gone. So they do what they can to communicate and try to pass on this message, no matter what. I mean, I've worked with many psychics in the past who have had really, really great success in helping a spirit pass on. One of the people that I've worked with for many years, her name is Nancy Laporta. She's a dear friend of mine. She lives in Virginia. She actually works for the Edgar Cayce Foundation out there. And one of the investigations that I was on with her, this spirit of this young man was appearing to people in the home, and he was, you know, he was very angry, and it seemed like he was almost vengeful, but Nancy was able to communicate with this young man. What happened is this young man lived in the 1950s in this house. And according to him, he killed himself. You know, Nancy kind of had to press him quite a bit, asking, you know, why did you do this? And he said through her, because he likes men.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is Northern Illinois in the 1950s.
Sure.
Okay. If you're gay, mm-hmm. that's almost a death sentence for you.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, you're going to be ostracized from your family and your friends and driven out of town.
Sure.
So because of his deep depression of not being allowed or, you know, feeling allowed to be who he was, mm-hmm. he took a rifle and shot himself.
Yeah.
And he was bringing out this anger on people because he had this anger because he wanted to be himself and he wanted, you know, to enjoy his life with, you know, men that he would meet down mm-hmm. the line. And, you know, Nancy was able to communicate with him, you know, you're now gone. You're not strictured anymore by these, social rules that you once lived underneath. Mm-hmm. You can be whoever you want to be now in your afterlife. And she was able to help him move on and to leave the house and pass where, you know, wherever ghosts go to, you know, heaven, the Summerlands, the great Chuck E. Cheese in the sky. I have no idea.
I think everybody goes to the Wisconsin Dells, really. I think that's probably where everybody ends
See,
up at.
We go there quite a few times a year, actually. So it's heaven. You know, according to my brother who lives in Phoenix, he came to visit us. We were up there for my son's 11th birthday. And he said to his husband that it's almost like a town where people go that survive an alien invasion. That's true. You know, it just seems that way. I never really thought of it before, but yeah, why not?
It is unique too. Yeah, I grew up in Wisconsin, so yeah, it is certainly its own unique place. Definitely,
it really is. So you know, it was fantastic. Not only being able to help this family, but help this, you know, poor soul move on, and you know, tell him that he's able to be himself.
Yeah,
and so that was really great. That was awesome being able to help this not only this family, but you know, this person as well.
Kind of try and make peace, you know, with the anger that he held, rightfully so. And, exactly. but try and go, okay, it's more than a new day. It's a new century. and things are different and you're on this side. Why is it, do you think, that sometimes spirits need this intervention from the living to say, hey, by the way, wake up, you're dead and everything's different. How are they not able to get that on their own or see that on their own?
I think it's because they are stuck on. I've always believed that there's a great chasm of consciousness mm-hmm. between the living and the dead. And on their side of that chasm, they still are reliving what they knew in life. You know, it's kind of like, again, I'm going to reference the show Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. But, you know, the Upside Down, it's kind of like the Upside Down mm-hmm. of Hawkins, Indiana. And I think that that's what it's like for them. They're stuck in this kind of Upside Down kind of world where they're still seeing things the way that they saw them in life.
Yeah.
But they're able to also interact with this world as well.
Rick Hale has been a lifelong paranormal investigator and researcher. In that time, he's experienced very positive ghostly encounters and some that would make you never want to come out from under the covers. Rick is the author of The Geek's Guide to the Strange and Unusual, Poltergeist, Ghosts and Demons, Behold, Shocking True Tales of Terror, and some other spooky stuff. Bullets, Booze and Babes, The Haunted History of Chicago and Illinois. He writes for paranormal publications and also appears on paranormal radio shows. Today, we dig into his journey on The Grave Talks. That wraps up part one of our conversation with Rick. In part two, does everyone survive the death of the body? How exactly does a soul seem to get stuck as a ghost for hundreds of years? How did Rick learn to change his opinion on provoking dark entities? And we discuss the Mandela effect and how it may actually work. All that and more in part two. Until next time, for all of us at The Grave Talks and Tony Bruschi, thanks for listening.
Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look amazing. What have you been doing?
You've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, if you qualify, Zelthy providers can prescribe semaglutide, the same active ingredient, at up to 90% less without insurance. Done all online.
No wait at the doctor's office or pharmacy?
No wait. Zelthy can ship the same active ingredients as other expensive GLP-1s to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less. That's #250 keyword care.